All right, I think we can go ahead and get started. Welcome to session 173, Climate Change and Alternative Energy, a Primer for the Non-Scientific. Just a quick little reminder, please everybody make sure you turn off your cell phone, turn them to silent, and turn off any other noisemakers. We'll go ahead and I'm actually really excited for this presentation that, as I admit that I am one of these people that doesn't have a background in understanding the science of climate change and things, and as I've been looking more into it, I've recognized that there's so much evidence that I've been ignoring, so I'm really excited for it. We'll go ahead and start. I'll introduce the people on the panelists, and we'll go ahead and turn the time over to them. First, we're going to hear from David Allred, who is a professor of physics and astronomy at Brigham Young University. I'm here in the PhD in physics and physical chemistry from Princeton University in 1977. He is an author of 100 scientific publications, and he and Janice Allred are the parents of 9 children and 14 grandchildren. Next, we'll hear from Alan Eastman, who is a chemist by day, musician by night, and for the last 8 years, he's been an accompanist for most of the singing at Sunstone. On the technical side, he has a PhD in chemistry and has spent more than 28 years in research department of a major oil company in Oklahoma. As penance for that, he is now the chief technical officer of Fire Green Energy, a startup geothermal energy company, and as well as a consultant in statistical treatment of chemical data. Next, we'll hear from Michael J. Stevens, who's a professor of management and business administration, department chair at Weber State University. He's conducted award-winning research in global leadership, work teams, and interpersonal competencies. He serves as co-chair of the Sunstone Board. And then lastly, we'll hear from Rachel Whipple, who is a stay-at-home mom, a permablogger for Times and Seasons, and is currently serving as secretary for both LDS Earth Stewardship and the Provo Peak 11th Ward Relief Society. And also, she was just putting to the Sustainability and Natural Resources Committee in Provo. So we'll go ahead and turn the time over to Dr. Eastman. Thank you.
You probably need to know the genesis of this session. Turns out that David and I and our wives go to the same dinner group once a month. And as we were talking with the other members of the group one night, we include 4 lawyers, a philosophy professor, a professor of classics, and a few assorted English majors, we decided that we needed to teach all of you sort of liberal arts types at Sunstone a little bit about science, because it makes things so much more interesting when you do. We spent a very interesting evening, one of our dinner groups, discussing the theological aspects of quantum theory for about 4 hours. We hate to see anybody else miss that opportunity. But at any rate, we decided that we needed to have something on some of the big issues of the day and that cover the boundary between science and the rest of life. So Dave is going to talk a little bit about global warming, evidence for, and why the scientific reasons why it's something to be concerned about. I have a business interest in an alternative energy company, so I'm going to talk about the pluses and minuses of the various varieties of alternative energy. We decided we needed to connect that with the real world and the spiritual worlds, so Mike is going to talk sort of about why people are reticent to make decisions that are really in their best interest in the end. More louder? Okay, louder, I can do this. And Rachel is going to discuss the connection between environmental stewardship and LDS theology. Dave, you're on.
Okay, we'll use this microphone, right? Is that
right now.
Hello, are we there now?
Yeah.
Not very loud.
Just go down. Okay, back to this. Okay, so I want to do 3 things in about 12 minutes. Is that about how much each of us is going to take?
Something, 12, 15, something like that.
All right. So I want to talk about the science behind climate change, in including how planets stay warm. I want to talk a tiny bit about scriptures because people bring them up from time to time, and the last little bit as why energy is part of this. Okay, so the question of how planets keep warm has existed for 200 years. And the reason I'm bringing it up this way is because a lot of people have suspicion against experts, okay? And the general opinion is, among many people, that climate change is a matter of scientific models. And the real answer is no. People first understood the what we call the greenhouse effect, that I'd like to call the transparent overcoat effect, 200 years ago. The scientist Joseph Fourier had figured out, as a lot of other people had, about the emission of hot objects. The sun heats the Earth is then warm and re-radiates its heat into outer space. But if you use the constants that the people were able to measure, the temperature of the Earth ought to be about 10 degrees below freezing. Okay? And it isn't. So he said, why not? And he had found out that somebody had gotten a blackened urn and put pieces of glass in front of it and discovered that it stayed warmer than the outside. In other words, the heated car effect was discovered also in France about 200 years ago. And he said, well, gee, maybe it's that way with the Earth as well and other planets. People did not know about the infrared, but he talked about dark rays, okay, obscure rays. People had knew that there was energy in the rainbow below red. And so they were saying maybe that those rays are being blocked by things in the Earth's atmosphere, and that keeps the Earth warm. About 80 years later, or 90 years later, just at the beginning of the 20th century, maybe even a little earlier than that, people had come to the conclusion that the past for the Earth was not warm. It was very cold. There had been glaciers all over Europe and North America. That's why this is called the Lake Bonneville. It was named after some of the people who were doing this kind of research who thought that there would be these glacial lakes. And there were all over the Northern Hemisphere, and later we found in the Southern Hemisphere. And people were wondering, well, why was it cold in ancient times, and why is it warmer now? And one of the reasons that was suggested was carbon dioxide. And a scientist by the name of, I'm going to mess it up right now, Arrhenius. Yeah, it wasn't Bangstrom, it was Arrhenius, said, I'm going to check carbon dioxide out. And so without computers, without modern stuff, the kind of stuff that a high school student could do for a science fair project, he measured the role that carbon dioxide could have in blocking heat being re-radiated from the surface of the Earth. And they figured out that, no, that wasn't probably enough to do the job. But he did come up with numbers that are surprisingly accurate. Again, without computers, without sophisticated models, he came up with some pretty good ideas that the Earth would warm up if you had more CO2. In fact, being from Sweden, some of his colleagues thought it would be an excellent idea if we did increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because Sweden was way too cold, okay? That's where you need the sophisticated models to understand what else you're going to do when you do that. Those are called the feedbacks, and we have understood feedbacks a lot more, and those are the ones that, in fact, you'll hear about where somebody's got a model that helps you understand them. So how do planets keep warm? Here's the model that people often do, and I did not redraw it, but it needs to be redrawn. And the reason is because on the, and I don't have a, oh yeah, I do have a stylus here, don't I? Do we have a laser pointer? How can scientists do anything without a laser pointer? Okay, so is this, am I going to destroy the world by pointing this one? There it is. Okay, so light comes in the visible range, and then there are these light rays that we can't see that try to get out, but they can't get out near the surface of the Earth, until you get to high elevation. Once you get to high elevation, then they go clearly into outer space, okay? And in fact, I was just up in Montana the first part of the week, and the temperature is 30 degrees colder up in the mountains of Montana than it is here. Elevation 8,000 feet, a little bit further north, and a lot less moisture in the atmosphere, and it radiates cleanly into outer space. So the greenhouse effect, or the transparent overcoat effect, now why would we call it that? Because the transparent overcoat is this idea. You put on a transparent overcoat, which is an insulator, but it lets visible light in. Once the visible light gets in and changes to infrared radiation, inside of it, it gets reflected back and you get hotter and hotter and hotter. And if somebody agrees to put on more coating on you, it just makes you get hotter. And I realized I really wanted to explain this when my brother-in-law, Paul Toscano, said, how can a few parts per million in the Earth's atmosphere, carbon dioxide, make any difference at all? And I said, do the math. And he said, you shouldn't have to do that. And my aunt told me that as well. He said, anything should be explainable to intelligent people in about two sentences. But then if you're a professor, you've got to pontificate too. So the idea, once we got through my arrogance, he said, oh, I see. It's like a black paint. You don't need much black paint to change the way things reflect light. So this is that right. Carbon dioxide is like an infrared black paint, but it's only a partial black paint. The really good black paint is water vapor. In fact, people ask that question. Since water vapor is so much better at keeping in heat, why do we even worry about carbon dioxide? The answer to that one is carbon dioxide is like adrenaline or any of the other hormones in our system. It's a master hormone, it's a master chemical that controls the water. This is where you do need to do calculations. But if you say, I will do the calculations as to what happens to the Earth if we were to take all the CO2 out. Now, we can't do that. Not even the angels can take it out. But if it were all taken out, the temperature of the Earth in 50 years would plunge to about 10 degrees below zero Celsius. We'd be right back in another ice age. But the CO2 keeps the water vapor there. Why doesn't the water vapor control when it's so important? And the answer is because it condenses out at night. You know, it's due. But carbon dioxide does not condense out any further. Okay, so now the CO2, among reasonably intelligent people who are well-read, comes up. And here's what Bob Benyon asked me once. We were sitting in line, I don't know, getting ready maybe to march at the role. He's retired at BYU. And he said, hey, guy, it seems to me like, we got methane clathrates at the bottom of the ocean, something that looks like ice but will burn if you put a match to it. And if that came bubbling up, we could have real fire. You know, is that the last days? There's one scripture that can be found in all four volumes of the LDS scripture, and it isn't follow the prophet, and it isn't love one another. I'm sorry, it's this one. It's the day cometh that shall burn as an oven. Okay? And for most people, this is under signs of the last days. And most people, my wife included, says, you know, I don't think that sounds like climate change. It sounds more like angels who will come in the last days when the Lord tells them, yeah, you can go burn it. But certainly, she said, global warming could dry things out and make them a lot more flammable. Okay? I don't know. But I just found it interesting. And I'm not the only Latter-day Saints that has, too. And see, there's the rest of it. It goes, and all the proud, and yea, all that do wickedly shall be a stubble, and the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, and it shall leave them neither root nor branch. Okay, is everybody on earth proud and wickedly? I think that's a little bit hard to pass off. On the other hand, climate change affects everybody on Earth. There's nobody gets out of it, okay? Some people get less, some people get more. Some people it's a good thing from the point of view of more ice-free days, but generally it has problems, okay? Is there evidence of climate change? Yep, lots of it. In fact, about 15 years ago, Newsweek had as its cover, maybe it was Time, I think it was Newsweek. Okay, evidence is in. There's climate change. Now we're going to sort out who are the winners and who are the losers. But that did not take into account the fact that some people were determined not to lose by count of lying and collecting people who would tell one another falsehoods. And the falsehoods are that, no, there isn't climate change, and if it is, it's not caused by humans, it's periodic. Nope, not true. It's evidence keeps coming in. Every a panel that has been appointed has always come back with, yep, there's climate change, and it's most likely human caused. And that comes increasingly true. Now, the problem with it is the effects take decades to show up. We all like our movies where there is a peril and the heroes go out against all odds, solve the problem, and immediately everything is good. Sorry, real world, it isn't that way. And humans aren't good at responding to problems that have decades to show up and then centuries after we cured them to even start showing cures. And this has been extremely demoralizing to a lot of people, scientists alike, to see it. Now, the other thing is it doesn't take large changes in temperature to end up having large effects down the line. So, when the average temperature of the Earth was 12 degrees Fahrenheit less than it was 17,000 years ago, there were glaciers like Antarctica, 3 miles thick, over the Great Lakes, and all of Ohio, the areas that you love in the Midwest, were 1 or 2 miles thick in ice. It took thousands of years for the effects to come in and thousands of years for them to go away, but they did go away and they will come again. The problem we have right now, and that's the one that people are realizing increasingly, is that we're bent on having rapid climate change. And rapid climate change may have the effect is we don't get to adapt to it. My son Ammon asked me, well, is there going to be a Netherlands in the next 1,000 years? And I said, no, it won't, it'll be gone, mostly. But, we got 3 minutes? Okay, good. Okay, but mostly, and my brother said, no, there'll be inhabitants in the Netherlands, they'll have gills. But the question is, does it happen in 100 years or 1,000 years? If it's over 1,000 years, humans can adapt and make changes. But if Miami goes away in 100 years, that's going to be bad. Okay, climate change. Yeah, we've only had 1 degree Celsius change in climate, and that is not enough for you to notice without sensitive instruments. Summers are hot, they've always been hot. Winters are cold, they've always been cold. Unless you're in Antarctica, and then, or in the Arctic, and they're a lot hotter and they've been soon. Okay, I wanted to show you this one really quickly because I wanted to make a point. There is a case for hope, and that is that we are in an ice age, okay? So God knew we were going to burn fossil fuels. I'm sure that every race, every world that ever has been that had fossil fuels is burning, because that's what you do. It helps to have an ice age when you get started. Why? Because that gives you some maneuverability, a little bit of time, if you are smart and not stupid and use things to excess, to make changes and convert to things that aren't quite so bad. I also want to make the point here that there is a time, the Permian extinction, where the temperature on Earth, it doesn't show it on this graph because it was so quick and so sudden, that the equatorial regions reached 85 degrees Celsius and the poles were 40 degrees Celsius, 104 in the day. The South Pole, it was 104. And it was called the day life almost died. Okay? Climate change can make it really bad. We have solved problems in the past. We solved the problem of the destruction of ozone. That's my word about God's grace. I believe the fact that we started in an ice age was God's grace to us. And Now let's not be stupid, okay? Let's see if we can solve the problems, okay? Oh yeah, we're over to Alan.
Okay, part of the problem, part of solving, we'll need this.
Yeah.
Part of solving the problem is stopping using so many fuels that give off carbon dioxide. The first way to quit raising the temperature due to carbon dioxide is to quit using so much of the stuff.
Come on in and just keep talking.
Okay, there we go. Anyway, this is a little bit about alternative energy and the kinds of fuels that we talk about. People talk a lot about our conventional energy sources. We've got oil, it's used mostly for transportation. We'll discuss that not very much. Coal is the oldest fuel and the dirtiest. It's suited to great big stationary plants, and you can see our civilization is built with big stationary plants with lots of wires going out to run electricity everywhere. Natural gas, you've all heard about the discoveries of natural gas in the Dakotas and the Bakken field and all the fracking that is required to get that out. There are lots of questions about that. The big question that I'm asked all the time is, will we ever run out? The simple answer is no, we won't. But that's not a very good answer. A much better answer is no, but over time energy is going to get more expensive, a lot more expensive. In practical terms, we will run out of cheap energy. There's no doubt about it. And our planet's health and our own depend on using more renewables. We're going to eventually run out of gas and oil and coal that we can afford, and we need to cut down on CO2. So we need to start using some renewable energy sources. A lot of people have said, well, great, when oil gets too expensive, we'll just start using renewables. The fallacy of that position is that you don't just turn the switch and all of a sudden go from using coal and oil to using solar and wind and geothermal. You have to somehow get those things ready to go, and we're looking at a 20 to 30 year span to start to go from the lab to full commercial scale for virtually any technology, especially something as complicated and as large as our national energy supply. So it really makes sense to start funding and perfecting some of these alternative sources. So what I want to do for the rest of my time is go through the main potential alternative energy sources and tell you from my point of view as a scientist who works in alternative energy, what the pluses and the minuses are to some of these technologies, so that you know that none of these are perfect, but they all have some potential. Let's start out with where electricity comes from, since I talked about that already. Nearly 45% of our electricity comes from coal, 20% from nuclear, about 23% from natural gas. Renewables, 3.6%. Not too great. Well, there's about 7% from hydroelectric. So we'll talk about these sources and a bunch of others. The problem really is, as Dave mentioned, is emissions. What do you get out? Well, not only do you get CO2, but coal is by far the dirtiest. You can see hard coal, brown coal, fuel oil, other oil, and gas on these slides. Not only do you have CO2 emissions, you get sulfur dioxide, you get nitrogen oxides, and you get carbon monoxide, you get particulate matter, all kinds of nasty things you get from coal. You get some of the less nasty things from other energy sources. But sooner or later, we're going to have to cut down on coal. Clean coal just is not going to do the job. It's too expensive. So let's talk about coal. We consume about, that shouldn't be million, that should be billion. We consumed about a billion tons of coal in 2010, 90% of it for electricity. There are three different kinds of coal power plants. The oldest and the dirtiest uses pulverized coal. That's about 90% of electricity production. It's thermal efficiency. How much electricity you get out compared to how much heat goes into the plant is only a little over 32%. So the other 68% is wasted. It just goes into the air, the cooling gas, into cooling towers, whatever. Fluidized bed, where instead of pulverized coal, you grind it until it's about the size of face powder. and then you just bubble air through it to burn it. That's somewhat more efficient, but unfortunately it leads to no decrease in emissions because the coal companies can use cheaper coal, lower grade with more impurities in, so you don't get any decrease in emissions. The latest hottest thing out is what's called an integrated gasification combined cycle plant, which sort of uses coal. What they do is they take the coal, they gasify it to carbon dioxide and hydrogen, and then they burn that. That gives you 50% efficiency. The problem is that it's extremely expensive to do so. In order to get the coal to that mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen, which is called synthesis gas, you have to build a plant that operates at about 1,800 Fahrenheit and about 600 pounds per square inch pressure. Very difficult to build things that work that hot under that kind of pressure, and extremely expensive to build. There are 4 pilot plants currently in operation, but that's it. The other problem is if you take the CO2 out of the plant stack gas, it takes 30% of the power consumed in the plant to separate that CO2 out. That's why power plants do not do it right now. If every power plant were forced to take the CO2 out of their stack gas, we would have an immediate drop of 30% in all the electricity that's available to us. And nobody wants to do that. That's why people aren't taking CO2 out now. How about natural gas? Well, is that the solution to all our energy problems? Well, there's lots of discoveries in shale formations. Let me show you how it works. You drill a hole. In conventional oil drilling, you drill a hole straight down. You can put a fracture out that goes into the horizontal beds, and the oil or gas flows into that. In the latest natural gas thing, you can do directional drilling, so you can actually change the direction the drill stream goes, so it goes horizontal in these nice horizontal shale beds, and then you fracture it. By fracturing, what you do when you fracture is you pump in very water and fracking fluid under lots of pressure that cracks the rock. The gas flows through the cracks and the well bore and out you go. The trouble is, you can get through some of these impermeable layers with your fracture, and you can get into the aquifer. Not good. And that happens far more often in fracking for gas than it does for oil. Renewables. There are several main contenders. Nuclear, hydropower, solar, wind, geothermal. The best strategy is probably all the above. Let's fly through these a little bit. Nuclear energy. No emissions. Baseload power. It's available 24/7, 365. With wind and solar, the wind has to blow and the sun has to shine. Nuclear doesn't care. It can be cost-effective, but there are some disadvantages. Nobody knows what to do with the nuclear waste. It'll last for thousands of years. It uses lots and lots of water because you've got to cool that hot stuff. Older technologies can be dangerous. Look at what happened in Chernobyl. Old technology and not very safe. And finally, there's a fear factor. People are afraid of nuclear. And probably with some justification. Pluses and minuses. Nothing's perfect. Nothing is totally horrible. Let's look at hydropower. It's very clean. No emissions. Operating costs are really low. But you've got to build the dam first, and that's expensive. And it creates recreation areas. People like that. On the other hand, costs are really highly front-end loaded. Virtually every place that's suitable for hydropower in the United States already has a dam on it. So there aren't many places we can expand. And it changes river flow patterns and habitats. So it has a real effect on the environment. Again, not perfect. How about solar power? Everybody likes solar power. The sun shines everywhere, right? Well, not really. There's a little map showing where sun intensity is greatest worldwide. And you can see most of the areas where there are lots of sun happen to be deserts. No surprise. 2 types of solar power, photovoltaic. The sun shines on semiconductors and creates electricity directly. That's very nice. It's nice and clean and used, but it can be really dirty to make. Permitting is easy. You don't usually have big central power plants. You can disperse the power supply all over. Unfortunately, the sun doesn't always shine, and weathering of photovoltaic cells is a problem. They get dirty, they get old, they get pitted and cracked in the sun, And finally, it's expensive. It's getting cheaper. The other way is using solar concentrators. They're very clean in use, but they take a lot of land. Permitting can be difficult. Again, the economics are front-end loaded. Weathering is a problem. That picture, incidentally, is taken at a place out between Las Vegas and Southern California. If you drive past there, you see that Bright Star Project is what it's called. How about wind power? Well, there's a wind map of the United States. There you've all seen solar, we've all seen wind farms. Wind is really getting popular because wind towers are really cheap and quick to install. The technology is reasonably developed. Lots of subsidies available. Permitting is fairly easily, and it's really trendy. Unfortunately, the wind doesn't blow all the time. It's not available everywhere. It takes a lot of land. There are a lot of people, some friends of mine in the Audubon Society, who don't like birds getting chopped up by the rotors. And it's intermittent power, again, not baseload. How about geothermal? Well, the earth is always hot. There's three kinds of it. Conventional, you drill until you find a place where there are hot rocks plus hot water plus permeability so the water can get around. There are few areas, but it's pretty well developed. Something like 30% of the power in California comes from geothermal energy now. Unfortunately, if you look at a map, most of the shallow geothermal energy is in the western part of the United States. That's not where the water is. So one alternative is called enhanced geothermal systems, also known as hot dry rocks. So you drill down somewhere where you know there's geothermal heat, you fracture a little bit to make sure there's permeability, and then you pump your own water down. That works well. There are two plants like that operating in Nevada now. But it's still early in development. There's also CO2-based geothermal. I have to put in my pitch for that because that's what the company I work with does. Instead of CO2, it's like ETS, but instead of water, we use carbon dioxide. You can take the carbon dioxide out of a power plant and use it. If you happen to lose a little bit in the formation, gee, isn't that too bad? Now you've sequestered it. So we think it has even greater potential, but it's still pretty early in development. So here's the pluses and minuses. Conventional power is proven reliable, but there are corrosion sources. That brine that you use for geothermal energy has salt in it. It's corrosive to all get out. It's also hard to hit a spot because you need so many factors to coincide exactly. For EGS and CO2-based EGS, front-end loaded for financing, so financing can be a problem. On the other hand, there's CO2 everywhere. We think that the CO2-based stuff is competitive, cost competitive with natural gas, but we don't have a demonstration of that. So this is really early. What's best? Well, no one solution is going to be perfect. There are technical problems, there are economic problems. Part of the problem is that the existing systems are already pretty well-established technology and fully amortized financially. So how do you have something that's new and kind of untested going up against something that's been running forever? It's like trying to run your little homemade go-kart against the local Ferrari. It's going to be tough. Competition is tough. They're trying to do it anyway. The existing systems don't have to pay for their own side effects. Some of the non-baseload power, the ones that don't operate 24/7, are going to require energy storage. That's problematic. How do you store enough energy to run a city when the wind stops blowing or when the sun stops shining? There are people working on it, but the final answer isn't in there. Finally, capital for new energy projects is difficult because people have the idea that, well, what we've got now is always going to be there. It won't. I'll leave that on there for a second. That's where our energy comes from, where it goes. Mike is going to talk about next why people don't always do the right thing. Right? I hope. Anyway, Mike, let me turn this over to you. One thing I wanted to talk about, but we don't really have time to do, is to talk about oil shale. And anybody who's interested in oil, shale oil, I'd be glad to tell you probably more than you want to know a little later. Mike, it's all yours.
Thank you.
Engineers in the house.
I did that last night.
Did you?
If it works, if the same thing will work today.
Oh, okay. Thank you. All right. So, unlike the hard scientists, I'm a soft scientist. These guys are on the engineering and the physics side. I'm on the social and behavioral side. Although my mentor at graduate school told me there's no such thing as hard science and soft science. There's hard science and easy science. What they're doing is easy. You won't talk hard, talk about human behavior and figure out why in the world they are so easily duped, right? That's the hard challenge. What I am going to do is give a quick overview here of a change model, or not so much a model, but more a discussion of some of the variables or issues that relate to the question of what causes the barriers that get in the way and keep change from happening. I'm going to tackle this at two levels, both the systems level and then what we would call the individual level. Now, the two are interconnected in important ways, but the idea of studying change in human change and systems change looks primarily at what are the barriers in place that keep the change from happening that you want or that you desire. At the systems level, there are clearly things of an infrastructure nature, right? So some of the things that Alan was talking to about the technologies that are already in place, using networks, for example, for the distribution of gasoline for automobiles, has a very deeply entrenched, very expensive infrastructure to put in place. But the fact that it's there creates an overwhelming inertia that gets in the way of things like electric car recharging stations. There's much greater risk because there is no infrastructure. And so you get into this dilemma where you find people making calculations saying, that Nissan Leaf is pretty attractive. I do a lot of commuting and I would love to not have to go to the gas pump two or three times a week. But what happens if I have to commute long distances and I get somewhere and I can't charge my battery and make it back home? So infrastructure, inertia, things of that nature. The status quo is always much easier to navigate and embrace and work through because it's the known. The limited view of the exchange. Now, this is one that is most germane, I think, to the question of global climate change because of the issue of what the economists call externalities. Okay? Global warming is the most significant, perhaps most catastrophic economic externality in human history. What is an externality? Okay, this is a little bit of Econ 101. An externality is a cost or sometimes a benefit of a transaction that is not accounted for in the price of that transaction. Okay? So if I need to buy 100 feet of copper wire, okay, Kennecott Copper, lo and behold, they have a mine where they mine copper ore, and they can produce that copper. Now, both Kennecott Copper and I, as the purchaser, will look at this opportunity to engage in a transaction. They'll produce the copper wire, and I will pay the money in exchange for that copper wire. Now, of course, as a consumer, I try to get the most copper I can for the least amount of money. And of course, on the flip side, what's the producer trying to do? They're trying to produce as little copper as they can for as much money, or in other words, to try to squeeze their profit margin up rather than down. All right. So Kennecott Copper's motivation is to squeeze every conceivable cost out of their operation and not have to incur that cost. So what that means is they don't recapture the gases that are coming out of their smokestacks, because that's a cost, and they would have to either pay it and take it out of their profits or build it into the price that they have to charge me. Now, on my end of that equation, I'm not interested in the costs associated with running Kennecott Copper. I just want to get good copper at a cheap price. So the cheaper the copper, the more of it I'm going to buy. And then when I go and pay Kennecott for that copper, the costs of the environmental impact that takes place as they produce that copper could be an externality if it's not forced into the price of that market transaction. So that's what the essence of global climate change is all about. You and I buy gasoline. We burn it. It emits this CO2. But you and I don't either pay directly for that carbon, and it's part of the transaction. It's not reflected in the price. I'll get to how you deal with that in just a minute, but that's an important consideration. Other systems level barriers is that you have specialized experts who become displaced. You have engineers who work for Phillips Petroleum who, if they don't get into some other line of energy work and petroleum fuels went away as a source, their expertise would no longer be valuable. You have losers in terms of established power relationships. Power relationships often extend and reflect the resource allocations, meaning the money, the income, and the profits that flow from it. Now, this last bullet, the established resource allocations, is no small consideration. And I think is at the heart of why this is socially such an extraordinarily intractable problem at this time. It is not the technology. It is not the empirical knowledge. It is the fact that there are people, there are players in the industries of burning fossil fuels who have trillions of dollars at stake if it goes away. Okay, that's trillions of dollars. The estimate of all of the fossil fuels that are in the ground that have yet to be extracted and burned are just estimates, but the coal, the oil, the other fossil fuels sitting around waiting to be extracted and processed so that you and I can buy them is somewhere on the order of $26 trillion. Okay? To give you an idea, that's about half of the world's GDP. So the thing to keep in mind is that if you're Exxon or if you're the Koch brothers, the stock of your price today reflects the value of those resources in the ground that you have a right to extract over the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years. If you're Saudi Arabia, your entire fiscal solvency is dependent upon extracting those oil reserves under your sand. This is no small consideration, because if we're serious about not trashing the planet through the burning of fossil fuels, we need to be ready, willing, and able to take a write-off in this one industry of trillions of dollars. Now, you and I might be able to do it, but I guarantee you the Koch brothers are not interested in that particular path. Now, at the individual level, this is where, you know, you and I, at the micro level, jump in and start getting affected and interacting with these systems level barriers. At the individual level, when you and I make individual choices, either for or against change, we need to take into account that lack of knowledge, doing, feeling, being, these sorts of things that get in the way. So what do I mean by knowledge barriers? Knowledge barriers means you simply don't know and appreciate and understand either the models involved or the data involved. Okay? The scientific and empirical data related to global warming, even for non-scientists, is not particularly intractable. It is easy to explain. It is easy to connect the dots. And that's not generally the problem. It's not the sophistication of the science or the data. The problem with the knowledge barrier is that far too many of us have bought into, for lack of a better word, not to put it mildly, the propaganda of those who have $26 trillion at stake and want to keep us from understanding the facts about what's going on. That, for me, is the most intractable. There are, nevertheless, also barriers that pop in that relate to the skills and abilities that we have to make the change. So, for example, do I know how to ride a motorcycle? You know, do I know how to ride a bicycle? Those sorts of things. Do I know how to install electrical panels on the roof of my house? Well, no, I might not, but I'm sure there are people out there. But we need those kinds of knowledge. Do I know how to operate and work with, and do I have the skills and abilities to use the new technology? Feelings, or the emotions, the affective responses that we have to the change, are probably more substantial than the skill set component. The feeling has to do with what do you prefer, what do you like, what are you more comfortable with. Okay, I'm more comfortable sitting in, you know, my own personal car, driving around town or commuting to work, than I am on public transit. Okay. Now, these things can change, but they are interrelated. The more comfortable you get with skills, the easier it is to become to lower these affective barriers, so that the more competent you are, the more comfortable you feel. The more comfortable you feel, the more competent you are, the likely you are to use the technology or the skill, and the more better you understand it. Now, the last one, the character and values, this is one that I think also has some important potential, but it's also the one that's subjected to propaganda. This is one way in which the knowing barriers and the being barrier are interconnected. I'll give you an illustration. How many of you own one of these? A diamond. What is the inherent or intrinsic value or worth of this gemstone? What do you use it for in terms of utility, its function? And the answer is? You can cut glass, okay. You can drill holes, but I'm guessing the ones on your jewelry you don't use for that, right? In fact, diamonds are one of the most abundant gemstones on the planet. Why do we pay thousands of dollars for this particular stone?
Because of media and back in the 50s.
Even farther back.
It was the 30s that they started this campaign. They had a whole bunch of them. They wanted to be able to market this. They think that it was back then when we were receiving the rubies. You were just a simple fan. And they needed to see that your worth, your relationship, your love is what is embodied inside this.
So it was a combination of monopoly and Madison Avenue, advertising. Yeah. Okay.
And it still looks the diamond mines are controlled almost by the De Beers.
It's declined, but early on, how many of you heard of the De Beers cartel? Okay. They essentially cornered the world supply of diamonds about a century ago. They decided, well, let's make some money off this by telling people they're really, really valuable and neat and they're forever. And they would give them away free to Hollywood celebrities, and the rest of us saw this and thought, that's pretty cool. I should spend thousands of dollars on this too. And it worked. So we value this, we spend thousands of dollars on this, right? So that's why it has a clear and significant market value. What about this?
To me, do
they do.
Yeah.
Now, it has a market value, but not a clear and direct market value, except for the beekeepers, they might. Actually, you usually have to pay them to come and get them off your property, but a lot of them will do it for free, but they get to keep the bees, right? But there's no entering on the spreadsheets of the agribusiness firms for the value of that creature. What about this? Does this have a clear and significant market value? A Hummer. Yeah. It has a clear and significant market value. And this does not. In fact, it doesn't have enough market value to sustain itself. It has to be subsidized. The front market. Local rail transportation. Does this have a clear and significant market value? Yes. And this does not. These are all examples that are manifestations of the values that we have bought into. They reflect our character. They reflect our nature. Values have to do with the question of what do you aspire to hold or to attain. And so when we look at these kinds of considerations, those are some of the barriers to change. And if we could stop looking at honeybees as inconsequential, or the polar ice cap as inconsequential, then we would begin to see the kind of change towards that which is good and desirable and worthwhile that would be of value. All right, so recommendations and solutions. Now, let me say up front, clearly, if I had a list of recommendations and solutions that were easy to implement, we wouldn't be having this panel in the first place. Okay? But I will point out to you where we have some significant issues. Education, communication, the basics of how science works. What do I mean by that? Not just in terms of experimentation and collecting data and all the rest, but there's a part to the science that the public simply does not understand, and that's the way in which communities of scientists build consensus such that the scientific agreement among climate scientists that global warming is real and human-caused is 97%. Whereas the public thinks it's only about 45%. 97% consensus in any scientific field is just, it's beyond extraordinary.
Right. Yeah.
It is beyond extraordinary.
Just doesn't
happen. This, you know, you put a couple of physicists in a room and you ask them what time it is, they can't agree. Their response is, well, it depends how fast you travel.
Yeah.
How much gravity are you experiencing?
Exactly.
Right? They can't even agree on what time it is. This is extraordinary. This is overwhelmingly, it's a done deal. So why in the world do we not appreciate or understand it? I would submit it's this one, right? The propaganda. There are $26 trillion that the invested interests are willing to spend in order to keep the fantasy alive that global warming is not real. Now, a few years ago, the consensus became so overwhelming that the strategy of their propaganda shifted. Oh, okay, well, it's real, okay. We admit that, but it's not humans. So there's nothing we can do, right? because it would be too expensive, even if it were. Change agents and champions. The impact of leaders and opinion shapers is essential. In other words, it's a way of saying, let's reverse the flow of propaganda and see if we cannot come up with a few more celebrities like Al Gore on the side in favor. In fact, I'm not much of one to engage in what-if kind of history, but what if Bush v. Gore had been decided the other way? Bush v. Gore followed by the Kyoto Protocol. Implementation of known solutions. This is one place where we could actually gain some traction. This is an area in which there are very simple and straightforward fixes to things like externalities. Okay? In other words, forcing producers and consumers to pay for the cost of the transactions that were otherwise external. You can do that through government regulations. How many of you remember back in the 70s when we got rid of unleaded gasoline and moved to catalytic converters? That was a regulation, okay? Now, of course, and there are pros and cons with each of these, but government regulation requires enforcement, monitoring, and watchdogging, and all the rest, but that is an option. When you get to the question of global climate change, who's going to be the watchdog? Who's going to provide the oversight and make sure that regulations are enforced and violators are punished? There is no clear answer to that. Explicit incentives for desired behaviors, that's what we call a subsidy. Okay? They work in many cases. You provide subsidies to Solyndras of the world. You provide subsidies for the front runner, for light rail transit. You make it more attractive. You provide subsidies for the new and alternative energies. And at the same time, you can use coercion for the undesired behaviors. You can put a tax on the behavior that you don't want. We did it with cigarettes. We call it a sin tax, right? Because the idea is that, okay, we've concluded that smoking is bad for people. It's bad for society. And so we'll put a tax on it and let people decide with their pocketbooks when it becomes so painful that they will voluntarily choose to spend their money on other things. That's what a sin tax is. What is the tax per liter or gallon of gasoline in Europe?
At least a dollar.
Per liter, which would mean $4 or $5 per gallon tax on top of the $3 or $4 that we're already paying now. That would have a significant impact on consumer behavior. All of a sudden, the two-hour commute on Front Runner will start to look a lot more attractive when you're looking at a commute bill, say, between Salt Lake and Ogden that's $1,800 a month, right? So it is possible to introduce systems-level change, but of course these require resolve. These require acceptance and commitment of the electorate so the politicians don't commit career suicide when they enact these regulations or when they introduce these subsidies, or God forbid they impose the taxes, right? But as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, taxes are what we pay for civilized society. I don't want government to go away. I want government to be good. And collective, collaborative coordination of efforts and decision-making, regulatory and policing activities between governments who have no direct coercion or control over each other is absolutely essential if we're going to be here as a species on Earth that looks anything like what we know. Thank you.
I just want to respond to what they said instead of saying what I'm supposed to say. I will control myself. So in the standard manner of an LDS sacrament meeting talk, I'm going to start with the definition. But rather than consulting Merriam-Webster or the Bible Dictionary, or if only they ever did the OED, I'm going to go to LDS.org because I want you to know how the church officially and publicly defines the word stewardship. It says, a person who takes care of the affairs or property of another is a steward. That which a steward cares for is called a stewardship. All things on earth belong to the Lord. We are his stewards. We are accountable to the Lord, that we may report on our stewardship to God's authorized representatives. When we receive a calling of service from the Lord or his authorized servants, that stewardship may include both spiritual and temporal affairs. Now, you can tell that while our stewardship is in there, it is not the most overemphasized doctrine that we have in the church. But if you even start looking, it's going to pop out at you everywhere. On the St. LDS.org page, it's got a list of scriptures. Thou hast been faithful over a few things, I will make thee a ruler over many. Unto whom much is given, much will be required. The parable of the unjust steward, the faithful steward shall enter into the joy of his Lord. Every man is to give an account of his stewardship. He that is faithful and a wise steward shall inherit all things. The Lord will make every man accountable as a steward over earthly blessings. And be diligent that thou mayest be a wise steward. But this is just the beginning of scriptures that relate to the earth and our stewardship responsibilities. So I'm going to go through my own personal list here. 1, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Now, I recently heard an excellent critique of this, of our application of this injunction. A caller to the Logan Public Radio Show, Access Utah, said her grandmother used to say, I see a whole lot of multiplying, but not a lot of replenishing, which I thought was fantastic. That was on June 25th, and it was a lot of fun being on the show. The command to Adam is that he dress and keep the garden, and then later to earn his living by the sweat of his brow. His job is to replenish the earth, to restore that garden state. So for us to replenish, it's to give back what we use and to make more abundance for others. Going on to Doctrine and Covenants, this is the best one. This is the one that everybody trots out. The earth is full, and there is enough and to spare. Yea, I prepared all things, and have given unto the children of men to be agents unto themselves. Sometimes people are tempted to stop reading there, because doesn't that sound great? We've got enough! We don't have to worry about it. But keep reading. Therefore, if any man shall take of the abundance which I have made, and impart not his portion, according to the law of my gospel, unto the poor and the needy, he shall with the wicked lift up his eyes in hell, being in torment. That's why they don't keep reading.
Amen.
We must care for the poor, or we are under condemnation. One of our descriptions of Zion, the most perfect human society possible, is in Moses, where the Lord called his people Zion because they were of one heart and one mind and dwelt in righteousness, and there was no poor among them. Don't we want God to establish again his Zion on this earth? And usher in that second coming, should we at least try to be living in some ways like a Zion people? We must strive to make this a reality, and one way to do so is to not consume so much of the earth's resources that our lifestyle is built on others' poverty, that our overconsumption makes it so that others have less than they need. The gross consumption and inequitable distribution of wealth, goods, and opportunity that we have embraced along with capitalism is keeping us from Zion here and now. We need to exercise self-sacrifice and self-control. We need thankful hearts and generosity, not just of spirit, but also of our material possessions. Going on, D&C 59. Yea, all things which come of the earth and the season thereof are made for the benefit and use of man, both to please the eye and to gladden the heart. Yea, for food and for raiment, for taste and for smell, to strengthen the body and enliven the soul. And it pleaseth God that he hath given all these things unto man. For unto this end were they made, to be used with judgment, not to excess, neither by extortion. And in nothing doth man offend God, or against none is his wrath kindled, save those who confess not his hand in all things, and obey not his commandments. Now this is in a section of Dr. Cummins that's about keeping the Sabbath day holy, a time when we voluntarily restrict our work and our consumption in order to pray and fast and offer for our oblations and sacraments unto the Most High God. How are we doing on that? D&C 49. For behold, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air, and that which cometh of the earth is ordained for the use of man, for food and for raiment, that he might have an abundance. But it is not given that one man should possess that which is above another. Wherefore, the world lieth in sin. And woe be to the man that sheddeth blood or wasteth flesh and hath no need. I just totally ate a lot of chicken at Panda Express. Yeah, not good. It was tasty. Now, these are just a few of the scriptures. There are more, and they are painfully clear. This world is made for us, but we must use it well, and we must take care of each other. Elder Nash, Marcus Nash of the 70, recently spoke at the Stegner Symposium of Religion and the Environment here at the law school. He did an excellent and authoritative job because he was on assignment from the first presidency in making the case for an LDS environmental ethic. And having a general authority speak at that is the first time that's ever happened. This is huge. And the talk is online. I encourage all of you to go and look it up. He started with the spiritual creation of the world and went through to the need to preserve wild spaces. But the key point that he made, that he really wanted us to understand, is that the earthly mortal experience is necessary to the plan of salvation. And we must preserve the earth not for its own sake, but for the sake of all the children of our Heavenly Father, so that they may have the full measure of mortal experience, the trials and testing, to be able to experience blessings and beauty, so they may learn and grow and return to our Heavenly Father. The earth is our testing ground, and as such, it's necessary to the plan of salvation. His talk was called Righteous Dominion and Compassion for the Earth. So we must preserve the earth and its environment because we care about God's children. So we do believe in multiplying, getting more of those children, and replenishing. We believe that we all have to be born and come and live through experience here on earth. And we believe that we can all have this experience and even become a Zion-like people if we act in such a way that there's enough for all of us now and in the future. At the heart of our doctrine is this plan of salvation. The earth is its setting, Christ is our redemption, and for us, we have agency and experience. We believe as Mormons very, very strongly in action, agency, and accountability. We are people who do stuff, and we have responsibilities. We are free to choose, but then we must accept the consequences of our actions. When I was primary president, we had a lesson on choice and consequences. So you had the stick with choice at one end and consequence at the other. Go around and beat kids with it. It was so much fun. Actually, you know, you would do the thing where you'd, like, hold up the stick, and you're like, what would happen if I did this? And they're like, it's gonna fall! I'm like, well, I'm not trying to make it fall, but that would be the natural consequence of what I'm doing. The consequences don't always follow with our intentions, but we still have to accept them. We believe that to whom much is given, much is required, and he who sins against the greater light receives the greater condemnation. Now, this is not a pass for those who willfully remain in ignorance in an attempt to avoid accountability for their actions. Rather, we are repeatedly counseled to seek diligently and teach each other words of wisdom, to be wise stewards. As Elder Nash said, we must be prudent, realistic, and balanced. We depend on this earth to sustain life. The quality of the environment affects us and future generations. If ignored, it will be inconvenient and costly. We must not ignore it. So let's take up his case so that he is not a lone voice in the wilderness crying repentance to us. We must try to learn what the consequences of our actions are, both individual and collective, And that's the purpose of this panel today. Because once we've learned what the consequences are, we can make better informed choices. For we believe that we will be held accountable for all of the choices we make in this life, and we will be held to account for the consequences of our actions. We will be punished, each of us, for our own sins. We cannot assume that because the earth will be renewed and receive its paracycle glory, that we get a pass. It's like my children. So they're living in my house. At some point they will grow up. They will leave their bedroom, and it will be renewed, remade into a very useful room for me to weave in. But even though that room will be renewed at some point in the future, they still have to clean it up every day now. That is good for them. They need to do that. It makes it better for them now. Just that same way, we need the experience of being stewards now. Because this is where we're living now. And trust me, we do not want our earth to look like my children's bedroom. The LDS, it's better. I just redid the floor, so it's totally clean now. I don't know how long it's going to last. Okay. The LDS idea of stewardship is inextricably tied to the plan of salvation, to the creation, and our ideas of agency and accountability. And if we manage to live these principles, we just might live to see Zion. For Zion must increase in beauty and in holiness. Her borders must be enlarged, her stakes must be strengthened. Yea, verily I say unto you, Zion must arise and put on her beautiful garments. So let's act as stewards and help her get dressed.
Okay, we'll go ahead and open it up for questions. If you have a question, come up here so you can get your question on the recording.
Alan, talk a little bit more about using carbon dioxide in geothermal context. I'm not quite sure what the mechanisms are there.
Ken, very briefly, what you do is instead of using water, you just use carbon dioxide to carry the geothermal heat from the surface or from the subsurface hot rocks up to the top. In ordinary geothermal cycle, you pump water down into the hot rock, it passes through the rock, picks up heat. You bring it up to the top, take the heat out, and cycle. With CO2-based geothermal, you take what's called supercritical CO2. It's a phase of matter that is where you no longer tell gas from liquid. It's like a very dense gas or a very not-so-dense liquid. And you take that kind of CO2, put it down the hole, let it pick up heat from the rock, and bring it back up. The advantages that CO2 has is that it's much less viscous than water and has no surface tension. So the CO2 can get into places in the rock that water can't, so it ends up being more efficient. While we're at it, let me hand you this.
Sure.
Oh.
You can show this one right through once, though.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so this was on the astronomy picture of the day yesterday. Astronomy picture of the day yesterday. It shows the mean temperature of the Earth, how it's deviated from what the mean is over the last 100 and some years. So you got there's some pretty cold times in the 1920s. 1930s, Dust Bowl time, we had some warmer temperatures. In the 50s, a little bit warm, and then it gets cooled off, and then something's starting to happen around the 80s. And, yeah. Yeah, the poles get most of the deviation. Just thought you might be interested.
That's a pretty convincing demonstration of global warming.
Yeah.
I promised I would say a little bit about oil shale. I have a quick slide. As you know, Utah has been called the Saudi Arabia of oil shale. There is an awful lot of oil shale in Colorado and Utah and in a number of other places on Earth. However, it's a little bit misnamed. It's not oil and it's not shale, for example. Basically, what you do with this stuff is you mine it using fairly traditional methods. The normal way of treating it is you take and grind it up to about the consistency of face powder, and then you steam the heck out of it.
And that's what gets the kerogen, the organic material, off the rock. Then you try and put the rock back where you got it. Unfortunately, when you grind it up, the volume increases by about 30%. So you can't put it back. And they're talking about filling up all those blind canyons out by Vernal and Roosevelt with shale dust. And you can imagine some of the locals aren't very excited about that. To refine it, the problem is you end up with this kind of tarry stuff. And there's some real refining problems with it. When I was working for the major oil company, one of my jobs was to see what it would take to make refineries work with the oil shale they were getting out of the Piance Formation in eastern Colorado, western Colorado. It turns out that you can only use a couple percent of the stuff in the refinery. It contains far too much nitrogen, which is highly alkaline. The first unit, you hit the first processing unit in the refinery after the crude still is very, very acidic. And if you put too much shale oil in that refinery, you can kill $2 million worth of catalyst in about half an hour. Well, refiners are a little bit nervous about putting very much shale oil in their refineries. You can take the nitrogen out, but again, it's very expensive to do so. New methods work in situ in the ground. You heat it up. Chevron and GE were working on one where they stuck great big huge electrodes in the ground and passed an enormous amount of current through the ground for about a year to heat up the underground formation to a couple hundred degrees and get the shale oil off that way. They finally determined it was technically possible, economically a little iffy. One of the problems that I didn't mention is that when you're dealing with energy, there is a factor that people look at. How much energy do you have to put in relative to how much you get out? If you drill an oil well, you get about 9 times as much energy out in the oil you get as you have to put in to do it. If you're mining oil shale, the factor is about 1.5, not 9, which is one reason that traditional fuels and even shale oil and things like that will get much, much more expensive because you just have to pay more to produce it. Do we have any interesting questions for the panel? We have... You want to come speak into the mic so that we can, the tape will get it.
Yours was the least offensive of the things I heard here. I thought you did a really great job. You said that we don't know how to handle nuclear waste. Tell me what France, Germany, Japan, China is doing with their nuclear waste. They're obviously doing something.
Yes, they are. What they're doing is temporizing. They're putting their high-level nuclear waste in sealed containers, and they are stacking them.
Like we are.
Like we are.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is that the half-lives of many of the nuclear waste byproducts are measured in the thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. And frankly, nobody knows whether those sealed containers are good for 100,000 years. There aren't very many ways to test that. You can do accelerated aging tests, but the further out you go, the less accurate such tests are. So we really don't know if it's possible to get rid of nuclear waste in any fairly easy fashion. There have been suggestions.
What about breeder reactors?
Okay, breeder reactors are certainly a possibility. The problem with for those who don't know, breeder reactors take nuclear waste and use them to generate other isotopes that can be used in further nuclear reactions. That works very nicely technically. There are some political problems and some perceived security problems because some of the things that they generate are plutonium, which is fissionable, and one of the most toxic things known to man. So there are some people who are a little bit anxious about that, and frankly, the safety record of the U.S. nuclear industry has been pretty good. Once you hear about a big blow-up, well, not a blow-up, let me rephrase that, a big problem once in a while, But considering the amount of power that is produced, nuclear energy safety record is good. But there are political and perception problems that may prevent any further nuclear plants from being built. Plus, nuclear plants use a lot of energy. One they're proposing down for Green River, Utah, would take something like, yeah, they use a lot of water, would take something like 30% of the flow of the Colorado River in its average high year. Who knows how much it would take as the flow goes down. Not a great idea.
Yeah, one thing else you can say about nuclear power is that people in nuclear industry say that if the coal plants were held to the same standards of radioactive element emission that they're held to, then nuclear power would be considerably cheaper than coal power.
Yep.
Because the coal power plants have uranium, thorium, radium that just blows out of the with the ash that goes out.
Significant chunk of the fly ash is slightly radioactive.
Yeah, potassium too, yeah.
Yeah.
So I need to be really careful when I ask this question. It's for Michael and Mike mostly. It seems to me that the ability, everybody is presented with the argument that global warming is happening and is caused by humans. It is believed extremely differentially across the political spectrum. Brains are not that radically distributed across the political spectrum. Love for bees maybe is, but what? How do you account for the extreme that, I mean, basically all liberals accept it and a huge proportion of conservatives reject it? I reject the idea that all conservatives are stupid.
No, I do too.
No,
I'm of the same view. It's not because they just don't get it, but I'm not an expert in the field of propaganda and the way it works. Now, I know the word propaganda has a pejorative ring to it here in the United States and the West, but propaganda is simply a communicative device where you influence people one way or another. So if you want to call it advertising, that's fine. If you want to call it inculcation, that's fine. But the root of it is that they're trying to influence people into accepting a particular paradigm that reflects different core values and a specific mental model, right? So if you think in terms of the knowledge and the values there, you've really got a two-whammy kind of setup that keeps people entrenched in their worldview. Now, I don't know any data on, you know, whether the conservative mind is more inclined to adhere to mental models when countervailing data presents itself, or whether they're just more skeptical of the sources of the countervailing data. But the idea of this interface between your mental models about how the world works and the data that are inconsistent with that mental model, you've really only got two things. This is the scientific induction and deduction cycle. So you come up with a theory about how the world operates, then you come up with a hypothesis, you've got to collect data, and you look at the data. Did the data inform your hypothesis? If the data are inconsistent with your hypothesis, the overwhelming and natural human response is to conclude something's wrong with the data.
The confirmation bias.
So to hold on to that model and reject the data. And part of the propaganda machine from the business side of the conservative movement is the one that has the most at stake in a model that overturns the fossil fuel industry. The Koch brothers and all the rest are invested in the status quo. The status quo is nice, the status quo is comfortable, and conservatism, by definition, means we want to preserve the status quo.
Even though this doesn't address the political question, I think the book by Naomi Oreskes, The Merchants of Doubt, is an excellent one for this, because that's, you know, muck-breaking journalism at its best that exposes how a few people with political and financial agendas have exploited both journalists and lay people's lack of understanding about the scientific process and about what a scientific theory means, you know, the uncertainty that's inherent in that, in order to generate doubt when there's really consensus amongst those who are experts in the field. And they, this has happened with tobacco as well as global warming. And the problem is just a lack of understanding of the way that it works.
Yeah, there's a couple other things that happen. If you look at people's feeling about how you should make decisions and how much credibility you should give experts, there's a strong liberal conservative bias. That was one reason why I was interested in trying to help people understand that you don't have to be an expert. You don't have to have the complicated computer models to understand how planets stay warm and how introducing more gas will make the planet stay warmer. That's because I trust that. I think that people, you know, don't have to use experts. They should be able to understand things themselves and make good decisions. The other thing that goes on is that if we do a lot of really rapid change in our use of fossil fuels, it will seriously impact families who like to take their kids to soccer games and those kind of things. So there's a vested interest in just keeping things going the way they are. The trouble is down the line is that this is going to end up with a real smash-up. If we plan ahead, we can keep things good for families. I have 9 children. I have a lot of grandchildren. The reason I'm interested in this stuff is because I'm heavily invested in the 21st century. I don't have investments in bonds and stocks. I got them in children and grandchildren. And I'd like the world to be nice for them. And I look at it and I say, unless we make changes, we're going to have a smash. It's going to be a crash, and it's going to be really, really ugly. But a lot of people don't want to think about that. They just hope it's not true. And there are people who will tell them, no, don't worry about it. We can just keep doing what we're doing forever.
You can't reverse it.
You can't go back.
And
yeah, it takes 100,000 years to get back to where we are now. Hundreds of years to get back to anything. So, yeah, it's really bad in the long run. I mean, you know, you don't want to go to where it's going to be. But you keep hearing things in the stuff I read where the experts are alarmed because it was worse than the model had allowed them to do. There's more positive feedbacks that are causing troubles. That's why I put this one up here. This is an opportunity to see the costs that could go the other way. You know, methane released by Antarctic permafrost could cost the world $6 trillion, but it's distributed out among everybody, and it's mostly going to hurt the poor. Now, Jesus hates that, but
the Koch brothers, though.
Yeah. The financial interests don't care because they're not voting.
So on that optimistic note.
Yeah.
All right. Is it still going?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, for participating. Where it looks like we're out of time.
None of you mentioned at all the agricultural lobbying. Look at all the corn that was grown.